Committee on Judiciary to order. Today is January 26th, 2009. First thing I want to do today, doesn't show up on the agenda, is going to open a work session on LC 591. And this is a bill to get that through the process. Is there any questions about that, any discussion? It's relating to persons exempt from real estate licensing law. With no discussion, I'd like a motion to adopt LC 591.
So moved.
Okay, thank you. Representative. Can we have a roll call vote, please? Representative Stegner made the motion.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Excuse.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Excuse.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you. Motion's adopted. Next item on the agenda is House Bill 2308. We'll have a public hearing on that today. Would you like to give us an explanation?
This bill allows a trustee, personal representative, or executor to apply to the Oregon Department of Revenue for a determination of the amount of inheritance tax owed. Following payment, it would allow for a discharge from further tax liability to be issued.
Do we have people that come on up? Oh, I'm sorry. Here we go. Okay, please just identify yourself for the record and then go ahead.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Sheen. I am an attorney with the law firm of Samuels Yolen Cantor in Portland, Oregon. And I'm speaking to you today as a member of the Oregon State Bar State Planning and State Administration section. I serve on the executive committee of that section. And I'm here today to speak on behalf of House Bill 2308. The Oregon State Bar section has seen a need for this type of bill in order to provide personal representatives and trustees in an estate setting to have some closure. And by that I mean, under current situation, when an Oregon inheritance tax return is filed with the State of Oregon Department of Revenue, currently we have no basis to determine whether or not that return has been accepted, whether or not the State of Oregon Department of Revenue signs off on it or not. So it sits there in perpetuity without people knowing whether or not their return has been accepted. The statute that's before you as a proposed draft is very similar to Internal Revenue Code Section 2204. And the process we're proposing is similar to what that Internal Revenue Code has, which namely, if a personal representative wants to have a determination made as to whether or not their return is accepted, they can apply to, in this case, the Oregon Department of Revenue, and the department has 9 months after that application within which to decide to accept the return as filed and release the trustee or personal representative from personal liability or determine that there is a tax issue that needs to be addressed and proceed. I've heard that the department may have some staffing concerns on this issue, but taxpayers of the State of Oregon are sitting out there basically with no way to close out or determine that a tax return is final and accepted. Also, there is no statute of limitations. So basically, however, there is under the income tax law, which is 3 years. So we're proposing under this bill to have 3 year statute of limitations for inheritance taxes and also provide a means by which a personal representative or trustee can apply for a discharge. So with that, I'll open it to any questions that the group might have and would like to reserve some time to respond later.
Are there any questions? Well, thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate your expertise on the matter. Next, I would call Peggy Woolsey and Jody Weiser. Please go ahead and just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Peggy Woolsey. I am a retired state worker. My position until January 1st of this year was the state's inheritance tax auditor. I am currently a member of SEIU Retirees, and I'm a member also of Tax Fairness Oregon. My concerns with this bill are I would hope that you would look at this closely to avoid any unintended consequences to Oregon's revenue or expenses. I have some questions, and I'm not sure exactly how this would be addressed. I do know that the estate unit is overwhelmed and understaffed. I do have some questions, though, about the inequity because of the fact that many estates are not represented by attorneys or CPAs. Many of them would not know that they could apply for this determination. Currently, we have in statute ORS 118250, which orders the state to issue an inheritance tax receipt upon the completion of the processing, which we do. And that does not prevent us from opening it to audit, but it is very unlikely. In the 6 years that I was in that position, I only opened up for audit twice after issuing the receipt, and that's out of many thousands of returns. 4 years ago, the law changed and required more intensive work on the returns because we separated from the federal. And we needed more people. We did not have more people. The estates took much, much longer to close. And that is probably what has brought this need forward or this. And it unfortunately, it would only speed up the processing for the people who had attorneys who knew to apply for it. It does not increase the staffing. My other question is that per ORS 118100, Internal Revenue Service can do an audit, notify us, and then we can go back and determine that the Oregon tax has not been sufficiently high enough, and we can then set up a bill and bill the estate. Would this bill preclude implementation of 118.10? I'm sorry, 0.100. The IRS currently has a superior system of auditing because they use attorneys, which are more qualified. They have a greater number of auditors, and they take much longer than 9 months usually to audit a return. And so I see a disconnect between what this bill might require and the reality of getting the information from the Internal Revenue Service. Currently, the Oregon Department of Revenue only requires that a person have 24 credit hours of accounting education in order to become a tax auditor one. A tax auditor one is a junior auditor, does not require any experience in multi-entity audits, and so it is extremely unlikely that any future person in that job would be able to do the multi-entity audits. And it is very unrealistic to expect that the average estate would not have some multi-entity types of holdings in their estate. I guess my main concern is that it worries me that there seems to be a disconnect between what is required by this bill and what the reality is.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to ask you. You said that you were saying that a person without a lawyer wouldn't apply, or is it because they wouldn't know, but they could apply? Is that not correct?
Right.
Okay, thank you. Any other further questions? Representative Cameron?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Peggy, right? Thank you for your testimony today. You said your biggest concern is the disconnect between the bill and reality, and I guess I'm still not clear. I mean, there's a big disconnect between federal inheritance tax law and the state of Oregon, but I'm curious, what is it that there's a disconnect between this bill and reality?
Oregon is tied to the federal estate tax law as it was in the year 2000. So that we have different filing levels. The Internal Revenue Service would be auditing larger estates than we would, but they would be auditing with greater numbers and greater expertise. And so if they were to determine additional tax was due by an estate, then they would notify the state of Oregon. But if we had already closed because of this determination, would we be prevented from going back and collecting that?
Follow up, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So doesn't the federal government close their inheritance returns and claims?
They have a closing document that they issue, and that is usually issued within 9 months to a year.
After, if I may, Mr. Chair, a few questions here.
Yes.
After the filing?
After the filing. Besides their auditors, they have a huge team of paralegals in Cincinnati that scan the returns for anything unusual. And those people, if there's nothing unusual, they will process the return, put it through, issue a closing document. If there's anything unusual, they send it out to the auditor. The auditor then opens an audit, and the closing document would be issued at the end of the audit.
Is there a reason we could not line up with their closing date and their auditing provisions as a state? Not, even though we're disconnected on the dollar amounts and the size of our inheritance, since we didn't connect up there.
I think that it would be possible. You have to keep in mind, though, it will take greater manpower.
Okay. A follow-up, if I may. The other statement you made was that people are not represented by, that file inheritance returns are not represented by accountants or attorneys. And within $1 million exemption, do you know how many people that file inheritance tax returns with the state of Oregon that do not have a CPA or attorney who signs that on their behalf or signs that with them?
I can't give you exact numbers. There is a large group that will be represented by both attorney and CPA. There is another group that will be that will have only an attorney, another group that will have only a CPA, and then there's a large group of them that will have LTCs and other quasi-professionals. And there is a small group that will try to do it themselves. Now, I can determine that the small group that do it themselves with no professional help is probably less than 5%.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Oh, go ahead.
Is there something else you're suggesting we do rather than this?
No,
are you suggesting we don't do this or do something different or just do this and be bummed about it?
I guess I'm not really proposing anything. I am just asking questions and asking that you examine this closely.
Okay.
Because I am concerned about the staffing issues.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
I represent Shields.
What? I guess you somewhat answered my question. It seems like if you're suggesting that the fiscal impact of this could be significant because you might need two or three additional staff to process it, then I think we should have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is that the point that you're trying to make?
I think that that's a realistic way of looking at it, because law changes 5 years ago created a huge workload issue, and I want to help avoid that.
Can I make one follow-up? So in the case of where an inheritance tax would be operable in the state of Oregon, $1 million is the threshold for exemption?
That's correct.
And so if I could, so if somebody had, you know, five kids, then that $1 million could be divided five ways, and so it might not only be rich people who are receiving it, it might just have been the rich person at the top who had $1 million.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. And we have ordered a fiscal for this, but we don't have it back yet. Ms. Weiser.
I want to speak to
Jody
Weiser with Taxpayers Oregon. I'm sorry. I want to speak to this bill on a couple of issues. On line 11, it says that, well, first it says that the attorney or somebody representing the estate can file for a letter of a determination, and that's what's going to cause the push. Some lawyers are going to know to file for a letter of determination. So those, it's going to end up that either you have to have more staff, or those people who have a lawyer are going to get pushed to the front of the line rather than being dealt with equally to all other people who have estates. And then it says that the case needs to be closed at the earliest of the following, 9 months, or the others are about deficiency notices. Well, the 9 months might come before you would get a deficiency notice, because you might be waiting for what does the IRS say about this. My own experience with two estates, and these were not Oregon estates, they were estates in California, is that when we filed our tax returns, we paid taxes, and that was at about 9 months after the deaths. At that point, most of the money was distributed to the heirs. $10,000 was held in case either the IRS or the state of California felt that we hadn't paid the appropriate amount of tax. And that money was held in a trust account. We earned interest on it. And about 2 years later, that account was closed and we got paid. And having all benefits that we had had of government over the years of the lives of both my parents and my brother, you know, you file your taxes, you wait to see if something's going to happen. That's really kind of normal process. And the fact that you have to wait to get some of your money doesn't seem like it's a critical point. It makes sense that you've got a complex tax return and that it should be reviewed by both the state and the IRS to see if they concur with what you've put on those forms. And the reason the lawyers held money in trust was so they wouldn't have to come to us and say, you each need to write a check for $2,000. Instead, the money was there. They could pay the more additional taxes that might be needed, and if nothing more was needed, they could distribute it. Or if there was a refund, they could distribute it all at the same time. I personally did not find any problem with waiting for the process to take its dutiful time, and it concerns me that the statement is the earliest of the following. If it were the latest of the following, wouldn't be a big issue. But it seems to me that we're rushing a process that needs to have taken its due course. Thank you.
Are there any questions, Representative Smith?
And this may be something that the proponents could answer better, and maybe this will we'll talk in the hallway, or you know, we'll do it in another hearing. What happens if there are assets that we find out about after a determination is made? Right, and that may be something that was already covered and I missed, and I apologize for that. But do you have an answer to that question?
You know, I just tried to read the law.
Yeah.
And I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah.
And I couldn't make it out.
Yeah.
It isn't clear to me what happens if there's some stuff in our law that says that if the estate was wrong and hid assets through fraud, the state has up to 5 years
right.
to come back. But it has to be at least 25% of the estate. Well, you could have a pretty sizable estate, and 25% of a $10 million estate or a $100 million estate
Real
is
money.
A lot of money,
yeah.
and you can't come back on it unless it meets that 25% marker. And that's part of what I'm hesitant about. I think that we don't want to circumvent the course of law that has worked for the state for a long time. The Peggy has struggled with the stacks of papers on her desk, and I'm sure the lawyers that have had to wait have been frustrated by that. But that was because there wasn't staffing available at the department to do more work. And then this summer, I believe it was, they hired a former employee to come back and really help them catch up. And that's, you know, that is part of why you get frustration when things get bogged down. That causes problems, but that doesn't mean you necessarily need to change the law.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, what I would like to kind of
identify yourself.
My name again is Jeffrey Sheen from the law firm of Samuel Joel and Cantor and Spinrad in Portland, Oregon. I thought Ms. Weiser's presentation was kind of interesting on the example out of California. California and the federal government both have the kind of statute that is being proposed here. The problem here in Oregon is that there is no statute of limitations to close out when the state is done being liable. What this statute reaches to is to deal with a situation where you may have a personal representative who's involved with the estate, maybe an heir or maybe a very small heir, faced with the issue of how much money do I distribute to the heirs, because if I'm going to be on the hook for years without knowing whether there's going to be further liability, then I've got to retain substantial resources to cover those tax liabilities. So what we're trying to do here is to create a mechanism exactly the same as what the federal government has, exactly similar to what other states have, to trigger a determination of whether or not the personal representative is personally liable. Now, if my understanding is that Oregon still has another statute for what's called transferee liability, where you can go after people who have received assets from an estate if there are further tax issues. And we're not trying here to cut the department out of revenue. We're really trying to establish a system so that taxpayers know when it's over. And the statute that is drafted in front of you is pretty much a carbon copy of 2204 of the Internal Revenue Code, which has the same provision. Now, one of the reasons why this is an issue here in Oregon now is because our exemption is $1 million. This year, the federal exemption is $3.5 million. So the Department of Revenue is receiving tax returns on estates that have no reason or requirement to file a federal estate tax return. And so in those circumstances, this is principally what the statute is focused on, is to provide closure for those returns where they do not have to file a federal estate tax return. Now, if a federal estate tax return is filed, the taxpayer has to disclose that to the department. And when the Internal Revenue Service issues a closing letter, which in the past Oregon was at the same exemption level, a taxpayer could rely on that closing letter because they knew that the state of Oregon would not be making any adjustments to the tax return. But we don't have that same level of activity any longer, particularly where you file a return for the state of Oregon, but do not have to file one for federal. As far as going after assets, I think I may discuss this, but Oregon has another statute for transferee liability, so if there is fraud, they can pursue it. And what we're simply trying to do is to take the person who's in charge of administering this estate and say, okay, there's a process here. In fact, there's two. There's the 3-year statute of limitations and then 9 months after application. And that application can't be processed until after the return is filed. Now, I think in drafting this bill, if there's a need for issues to push that out a little further, say 12 months, I don't think we have a problem with that. But I think part of this is just to create a process so taxpayers in the state of Oregon know when things are closed so that they can move on with their lives. This isn't meant to hurry up the process because right now there is no closure.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to make sure I'm clear on your testimony about the transferee liability, are you testifying that if the IRS, after the state issued one of these letters, assuming this bill is enacted, then the federal government finds additional tax liability, the state of Oregon would be able to pursue that against the transferees?
My understanding is that, yes, they would. Now, bear in mind that if a federal tax return is filed, there's usually going to be a closing letter that will be issued that will trigger that process. But the problem area really is the returns that are just filed in Oregon only. And the IRS will never be seeing those. So the administrative capability, if you will, that the state of Oregon used to rely on, namely the IRS auditors, only exists for estates over $3.5 million now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sheen, which brings up a couple. Do you typically reserve a certain amount of dollars back for your clients when we're talking about a situation like this? And that question is in two parts. One, if they filed a federal return, do you reserve for their state? And the other one is below when they don't file a state return, do you reserve for them?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, I typically reserve for whatever tax, if federal taxes is an outstanding issue, we reserve for that. If there's state taxes that have been paid, we typically reserve for that. So, and that money is going to be held for 2 or 3 or perhaps 4 years because we will get we know when the statute terminates at the federal level. But right now we don't know when the statute terminates for the state of Oregon. And the receipt that is issued that Peggy referred to is only a receipt. Have an extensive email that a Department of Revenue person sent to me saying that receipt does not close any liability, any issues are still open, the department can pursue. So, in effect, the receipt sort of acknowledges that maybe we're done with this thing, but the statutes are still completely open.
Just clarification, if I may. So I'm not real clear. Do you, after you've paid your federal taxes on somebody's account, do you withhold or reserve more, thinking that there might be more coming on the federal side? Or do you usually clear this is what we've paid and we know there's a closure here?
Until we receive a closing letter from the federal estate tax return section, we will hold additional money.
Okay, but that happens within 9 months.
It typically, it kind of depends on the estate. If it's a husband and wife and the first spouse has died, we typically see those letters in the 5 to 7 month range. If it is a non-married individual, we typically see those in the 8 to 12 month range.
Okay, one more.
But on a statewide basis, if you've reserved it, you're holding that for 3 to 4 years because of non-closure.
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the wording of House Bill 2308, it talks about requiring the department to give that notification within 9 months, but I'm unclear as to what remedy the person might have if the department does not provide in 9 months. Is that provided for in other parts of the ORS?
Chairman Barker and Representative Shields, if I recall, I handed my copy to Deborah Buchanan, but my recollection is that if first of all, a tax return has to be filed, and then if an application is made, then the Department of Revenue has 9 months from that period. If the department does not respond within that time period, then the representative or trustee is deemed to be discharged.
Okay.
Now, like I said, you know, if there's staffing concerns and issues, you know, we would see that as can move it out to say 12 months or something like that.
Follow up. So there is the potential of that costing the state some money if there was a liability there that was discharged at the 9 month point because there wasn't staffing to get it done.
The liability discharge that occurs in this bill is personal liability to the fiduciary who's administering that estate.
Okay. Not to the
Now, that daughter. Does not preclude the estate from going after the transferees. And okay. So, but at some point, it seems like we need to bring some closure here. And open-ended is not a good way to go.
Thank you.
Thank you. And it's... Yes, come up for it.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. And I did just want to be clear that the department is neutral on the bill. We don't have any objections to it. And I did want to just make some points clear. There was discussion of the fiscal impact. We did submit a fiscal impact of about $12,000 because we will be issuing letters that we don't currently issue. So we would be able to handle that with our current resources. Also, as Mr. Sheen mentioned, we see this bill as relieving a personal representative from personal liability. It does not preclude the department from asserting additional deficiencies and assessments of tax within other statutory periods that exist. The 3 years, if we receive a federal RAR that increases the value of estate's assets, then we would be able to act on that federal RAR. And actually, that can come in after the 3 year period. We have 2 years after receiving that to assert additional tax. So I believe those time periods do still apply. I spoke with staff in the program yesterday about how many returns we receive. They said of about 1,000 returns average in a year for this program, 70% of those probably would be returns that we would process, look at, and would not have any issues with the information on the return. So 70% of them, we could send out a letter of release, and we probably would not take any further action on those. So around 300 returns in a given year, we might want to look at and ask for additional information, do an audit on those before we send out that 9 month letter. I believe those were the only points I had to make, Mr. Chair, unless there are questions.
Questions. Thank you, Ms. Buchanan. Okay, with no further testimony on this bill, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2308 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2309. Give us a quick rundown on 2309, please.
House Bill 2309 addresses conservatorships for minors and would extend the age for termination from 18 to 21 years of age.
And I have Mr. Levy.
Members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Levy. I'm here on behalf of the State Planning and Administration section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm the immediate past chair of that group. I'm also a lawyer in private practice in Portland, and I've been specializing in state planning. The idea of this bill originated from comments that we had received over a number of years from practicing lawyers around the state, and that they in turn had gotten feedback from their hundreds and thousands of Oregonians around the state. The concern was and is that situations arise where children can inherit large sums of money, either from personal injury settlements — those wouldn't be inheritances, they'd just receive those sums outright — or from inheritances where there's no will, or from life insurance, or from awards and wrongful death cases. And in those situations, a recipient is normally entitled to have access to that money at age 18, no strings attached. And the lawyers around the state and their constituents, their clients, have had grave concerns that typical 18, 19, 20-year-old is not mature enough to handle such large sums, even though technically one is an adult and can hold property. The idea behind this bill is that if a young person receives property and a conservatorship is set up, which is the normal court procedure to protect the property until age 18, the 18-year-old cutoff age for that relationship will end at 21 instead of 18, giving 3 years more of maturity before the recipient has free access to the property. We model this bill on the laws of a couple of other states that have done this. We've also added some safeguards. The current statute still gives the probate court flexibility to permit control of the assets before 21 if particular circumstances warrant it. The bill also would not apply to a young adult's earnings before 21, that they'd still have free control of that. And the bill would not prevent creditors from getting access to the earnings of a young adult. But what it would do would be to give three-year additional period where the property would normally be held in a continuing conservatorship. I'd be happy to answer questions, and I appreciate the committee's time.
Thank you. I can see why you might need that, but I mean the argument would be, well, why not 25 or 22, or if we're going to move it, and why was it picked at 21?
Mr. Chair, it was a balancing. There's no I can't give you articulated why one age is the ideal age, but it was weighing of lack of discretion of young adults versus the right to autonomy, and this was the trade-off that we reached. I note that a few years ago the legislature approved a change in Oregon's custodial statute, where people leave money in Uniform Transfers to Minors Act or other custodial accounts, and we gave the people who left that money the ability to extend them until age 25. In this case, we thought that 21 was a good balancing act. And again, the lawyers around the state could tell you a number of horror stories where people under 21 get the money and go into party mode. So.
Mr. Chair.
Let me start down here with Representative Barton, please.
Mr. Levy, thank you for coming in. I'm wondering if you've ever heard horror stories from lawyers around the state about people who have gone into party mode after the age of 21.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, the answer is yes. I mean, there are people who are my age and older who go into party mode. So it's a balancing act. This isn't going to protect against every problem.
First, let me say, I think that this question helped answer the previous question, which is the reason you want to move it to 21 is so that when they go into party mode, they are allowed to drink. And I think that's, I think that part is helpful. The question I had is, who, and I do have various questions on just understanding this better, who is likely the conservator? Is it always a judge? Who is likely the conservator, or who possibly can be the conservator of a of a child who is whose parent dies, you know, without a will, intestate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, if a parent dies intestate, or if there's a personal injury settlement, a horrible accident,
yeah,
the conservator is appointed by the court. And under Oregon statutes, there's a priority. First priority is normally the surviving parent. If there is no surviving parent, it might be another older relative, an aunt, an uncle, an adult sibling. If there's no qualified family member available, it could be a professional fiduciary. It could be a bank, a trust company. It could be an accountant, but a third party.
The so my own challenge, we can talk, this will be, there'll be another hearing, we can talk about this. My own challenge with it is in my own limited experience for myself. I was 19 years old. My mother passed away. She was survived by a step-parent. His interests were different than the children's interests. My older brother, who was significantly older, but not particularly, you know, taking care of the family affairs, and it fell to me in a significant way to negotiate with my step-parent. And I was 19 at the time. And I'm curious, and so I could imagine horror stories on either way, right, for the overly party kid, but also for the responsible kid who is who has different has interests that might be different than the than a surviving conservator if that person, for instance, was a step-parent. And I don't want to deal with too many picayune factual scenarios, but I do want to sort of think about what are the unintended consequences, what are other consequences other than avoiding sort of the horror stories that we may be aware of or might not be aware of.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, again, I think you're touching on two separate issues. One of them is if there's just a difference of opinion on how to handle money, and I didn't get into it because of the interests of time, but the statute, the bill does provide that on page 2, section 3, subsection 2, the conservator may permit the protected person to retain possession and control of property and funds for living requirements as appropriate to the needs and capacities of the protected person. So let's say you have a 19 or 20-year-old who's going to school. The conservator could say, you know, you're not completely mature, but you're a lot more mature than you were a couple of years ago, and I'm going to give you a monthly stipend of X dollars a month, no questions asked, because I know that you have living expenses. So there can be a loosening of the reins between 18 and 21. Now, if and at age 21, the protected person will get the money in any event, no questions asked. So it's, you're talking about access to money during this 3-year gap period.
Yes, so my fiance's mother passed away when she was 20, and you came to the wrong, you know, a sort of unfortunate seat for you, and I understand that. But the, and similar situation, survived by a step-parent, and who, the last person she would want is her surviving step-parent, who is the most likely, not necessarily the conservator, but most likely conservator, I think, hearing you, the last thing she would want was that person making the decisions about what happened to the family home, all of which decisions were going to be made in a, you know, 1 or 2 year time window before she reached, you know, sort of full power. And so I'm curious about what happens in that situation.
Well, the other thing that I'd like to add on that is in choosing a conservator, the statute weighs different factors, but one of the factors is the older you get, the more the probate judge will weigh the protected person's wishes rather than the other factors. So if you have a 2-year-old and there's a horrible automobile accident and the rest of the family is wiped out, well, the judge isn't going to weigh 2-year-old's wishes at all. But if you have a 20-year-old, I think those wishes would be close to decisive as long as the 20-year-old has somebody in mind who doesn't have a rap sheet and is financially mature, financially solid, able to get a bond. So I think the question that Representative Smith was asking about the 20-year-old who gets money, I think that person's wishes would be weighed very heavily in the choice of the conservator.
Thanks.
Representative Stegler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Levy, essentially, I mean, no matter how you read this, what you're seeking to do is to impose an impediment on a person who, by virtue of happenstance, is under the age of 18 whenever the act, whether it's a personal injury or whatever, parents dying, whatever it is, but by pure happenstance happens to be under the age of 18 when that event occurs, that would bestow upon them, you know, these otherwise unplanned for riches. Correct?
Chair Barker and Representative Stegler, well, impediment's one way of describing it, another is safeguard.
Well, answer me this, Mr. Levy. If that same person happened to be 18 years of age on the date that this event occurred, none of this would happen, and that person would be, unless there were restricted provisions pursuant to a will, but assuming that this was, an intestate kind of situation, or it was an accident that happened when they were 18 and they got a personal injury settlement for a couple million dollars, whatever. By virtue, and there was no other debilitating factor. In other words, there wasn't a mental issue or anything like that, and there wasn't any other form of incapacity other than minor. So if they were 18 when this event occurred, none of this would happen, and that 18-year-old would be able to receive the do intestate succession and receive whatever, you know, the proceeds were from that estate, as well as if it was an accident or something else, they would receive the proceeds from that without any kind of impediment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Stegler, I can see there's a little bit of an inconsistency there. If the pot of money drops on a 19-year-old, there won't be the restrictions, but if they come before age 18, there would be. I don't have a perfect solution. I view this as a substantial improvement.
Well, I'm looking at this as perhaps a solution for something where there isn't a problem. I understand what you're telling me. The anecdotal information is that you've received. I practiced law for 18 years, mostly in an area dealing with families and juveniles. I understand all of that. But 18-year-olds can vote. 18-year-olds can contract to buy a car, to get their own apartment, if they so have the ability, to go buy a house, to do any of a myriad of things, to vote, to enter the military and fight in a war. They have all of those rights and rationale under the current law. But what we're seeking to do, by virtue of the fact that when this event occurs, that they are under the age of 18, is to impose upon them an impediment that otherwise would not be there but by virtue of age.
That impediment, when I draft estate plans for clients, for parents, and I always ask them, if something were to happen to you before your children are older, or how long would you like the money to be tied up in trust?
But that's their right.
And 95% of the time they want an age that's older than 18. So, you know, I view that as some significant evidence that parents, at least out there, don't view 18-year-olds as mature enough.
Well, I guess I'd proffer to you, wouldn't that really be more a statement of what that child-parent relationship is and how they want to continue to have control over? I mean, you know, it's hard to get behind what the intent of the parent is in drafting the will and the provisions of a testamentary trust. So in reality, what we're dealing here is with a situation where there isn't that impediment imposed by the parental, the people who are the parents in this case. These are those situations where there is no parent figure, either an intestate situation or you've got, like you said, a personal injury, some kind of a bunch of money that falls upon a person purely by virtue of their age.
I guess my response to that is, where there are parents who are doing estate planning, most of them have the best interests of their children in mind. I mean, occasionally they don't, but the vast majority, in my view, do. And so I'm making the assumption that if the parents who are missing were there, most of them would have the same view, that the best interest of their children would be to tie up the money past 18.
But they didn't. But in these cases, there has been no will that's been written or filed. So we don't know. We're purely guessing as what the parental intent might be.
That's right.
And we're trying to impose or make some assumptions based on what somebody else might have done. Okay, thank you.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Levy, I want to go back to Representative Smith. He had a couple hypotheticals, and any one of which may or may not be applicable, but it would not be hard to devise an applicable hypothetical. For example, he talked about the example of his fiancée, who would be 20. And you said that if someone was a responsible 20-year-old, that would largely be dispositive. Their wishes would be dispositive in any event.
As far as the choice of conservator?
In which case, and I'll take you for your word at that because that makes some sense, in which case, what is the purpose of this bill? Why don't we just take out the middleman and literally make the 20-year-old's decisions dispositive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, the distinction is that it's one thing for a person to have a good sense of whom he or she would like to manage the money, and it's another thing to actually put the young adult on the firing line. I do the same thing fairly frequently in trusts, where we give beneficiaries the ability to change trustees within certain limits, but yet not give them the right to name themselves as trustees or to withdraw all of the assets.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Levy, looking at your written testimony that you provided us, and you alluded to that this bill is being modeled after a couple other states, what they've done, and I see it's Colorado and Idaho. I'm curious, when did this concept become implemented in their states, and then how's it working there?
Chairman Barker, Representative Olson, I don't remember the dates, but my recollection is that the statutes are 10 years old or less. We did look, we tried to find reported cases in those states to see if there were controversies about the enactment of those laws, and we found none. We also tried to, we did Google searches to see if there was any dispute about it. And we found nothing, no controversy. There hasn't been a lot of publicity about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wissman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barker, this bill comes from the Oregon State Bar recommendation.
Mr. Levy.
Mr. Levy.
Mr. Barker.
That's okay.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Have you ever submitted this before, Mr. Levy?
No.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger?
Mr. Chair, is there a cost of the service of providing that conservatorship against the value?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, there is a cost with conservatorships, with any conservatorship. There are annual accountings that are required to be filed. If the conservator is not a family member, or even sometimes as a family member, the conservator may get paid. So one does have to weigh that cost against the cost of the the protection granted. Most of us who are in this business feel that the annual cost of a conservatorship in this situation is well justified by the risk of loss of a large part of the principal that's avoided or reduced.
You got an estate of $100,000. It costs you so much to do it, and you got an estate of $2 or $3 million. Are the costs the same?
Well, typically a larger estate would have more assets and more fees. So no, I can't say that it's a linear relationship, but in general, the bigger, the more complicated the estate, the more expensive it is, and the more that's at stake.
Just one last question. Give me an example. If you were doing it for me, it's $3 million. What's it going to cost me?
Hey, Rich.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, let's say that a $3 million estate is that the conservator is not a family member but a bank trust department. Their annual fees might be 1%, so that would be about $30,000. Typically, they have set up to do most or all of the annual accounting, so the lawyer's fees would be relatively modest in that situation. But the figure that I have in mind is roughly 1% annual expense.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill would change the age of termination only for conservatorships, not other protective proceedings. Can you tell us what's different about these? I'm just not familiar with this area of the law.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garrett, the other kind of protected proceeding is guardianship, which is a substitute parent for the care and feeding of a minor. We didn't attempt to change the age of guardianships for a couple of reasons. One of them is that there hadn't been the kind of persistent demand for this kind of change that we've been getting from the field. Second reason is that figuring out how to get clothing and food is more within the experience of and capabilities of an 18-year-old than managing large sums of money. There may also be constitutional limitations, but I haven't really looked into that.
Further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2309 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2284. You could give us a brief synopsis of that.
This is a general cleanup bill carrying over from last session that corrects grammar, punctuation, and some references that no longer are applicable.
Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council's office. House Bill 2284 is our revisor's bill, not the most exciting bill you'll consider this session, but important nonetheless. It's produced every session by our office, and its goal is basically to correct errors that we find in the statutes. The other main goal of this bill is not to make any substantive changes in law other than to make technical corrections. So what you'll find in here is a host of corrections of errors in grammar, punctuation. We take out obsolete provisions. We update references to federal agencies, for example. We conform language to the current legislative form and style, which you adopt as a rule in your legislative form and style manual. And we just do a lot of other technical things that for mistakes that we find in these bills. Again, the main point is that this bill is not intended to make any substantive changes in law. And you can see that if you look at Section 1 of the bill, which is a section that we've amended every year since the beginning of time, it looks like. And what that section says is that the legislature is fixing mistakes here, and nothing in this bill is intended to alter the legislative intent or purpose of the sections amended other than just to fix these mistakes. And you can also see in both the summary and the title of this bill, we've attempted to very narrowly define what's happening here. The title of the bill is relating to correction of erroneous material. in Oregon law. Again, that reinforces that you can't amend a whole bunch of substantive policy changes into this bill. It's just a technical fix-it bill. Over the years, this bill has gotten slightly smaller as we've gotten more conservative about what we put in it. We try to make substantive changes in the statutes in the bills that we draft for you in cases where you allow us to do so. Sometimes members don't like to fix other things other than the subject that they're most interested in. And so with that, I'll stop talking and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
For the newer members, this is a fairly routine bill, and it's just exactly as described, just trying to catch things up a bit.
Why are you looking over here?
Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I suppose more an anecdote. You know, it's good that you warned me now, but last night when I was trying to read the bill,
exactly.
I was caught off guard, and you did help me get to sleep last night.
Just hope you don't have to carry it and have all the questions for us on the floor. Okay, nothing further. I'll open a work session on 2284. And accept a motion to move the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I move then that House Bill 2284 would be moved to the floor with a unanimous. Let's see.
Do pass.
Thank you.
A little rusty.
Been a little while. Rusty. Thank you.
Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisman.
Excused.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson, just for time. Representative Barton will carry the bill on the floor.
Mr. Chair, may I be heard?
No.
You're done.
No further business before the committee today. Sorry about that.
Picayune bill? Is that P-I-C-A-Y-U-N-E?
It's relatively picky.
Same thing happened to me this morning in the other committee.
The last bit of business today, we have three LCs that we need to accept. I'll open a work session on that. LC 2112, LC 2596, and LC 2597. You're not taking any position on this. You're not required. I mean, by voting to accept them, you're not taking a position that you're supported or anything.
There are three. There we go.
And I'll accept a motion to accept those. To adopt the LCs, Representative Shields.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Shields. Moves we adopt them. Is there any discussion?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Excused.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Their bills are adopted. Okay, that we're done. Okay. Hearing no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Quick.
And then you sign.
Excuse me, was a good one.
We're chief sponsor.
That's not actually.
Are you serious?
Almost.
Why?
Let me open right then and there.
I know. All of a sudden, I realized that you're struggling.
The book of bunnies.
Like you've
never seen that.
I guess somebody that wasn't file a bill to prevent that from going in the library.
Are you serious?
Tobacco tax.